Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Good to see you all here. Thank you for coming. Today's talk is part of a tour organised by volunteers from the Institute of Engineering Technology. The Institute of Engineering Technology has 150,000 members across the world and is the second largest engineering institute in the world. It's licensed by the Engineering Council to admit members to register for Chartered Engineer, for Corporate Engineer, Engineering Technician, and details of these accreditations are on their website. The IET had fairly humble beginnings and was formed in 1871 when a group of people doing interesting things with technology formed a voluntary society called the Society for Telegraph Engineers, which had as its main objectives the advancing of electrical and telegraph science and to share knowledge amongst its members. Over the years, the Society grew and became what is today the Institute of Engineering Technology. Before I introduce today's speakers, I'd like to make a few thanks. Thanks to the Free Software Foundation, the British Computer Society, the University of Sheffield Electronics and Electrical Engineering Society, the Sheffield Linux Users Group.
Oh, no, you can't mention that here.
Oh, sorry, not thanks to them.
I don't want my speeches to be associated with groups that attribute our work to someone else.
Okay, sorry, not thanks to them. In fact, screw them, they can go away. What about these people? And not.
That's
Manchester Free Software Society, thank you. We'd also like to thank the Institute of Engineering Technology Committee for South Yorkshire, and a big special thanks to Bob. Without his countless hours, this event wouldn't be possible. So, quickly, a round of applause for Bob, because he's pretty well done. Okay, it's through events such as these that the IET is able to continue to achieve its goals of sharing and advancing knowledge. And today's speaker is a perfect example of sharing and advancing knowledge. He's an inspirational figure to many people. And in 1984, he launched the development of a new operating system. For those of you that don't know, new is free software. Everyone has the freedom to use, copy, distribute, and amend to fit their particular applications. The new system, with some other bits added that I'm not sure I'm going to mention, formed one of the most popular operating systems used today and is used on tens of millions of computers. For his pioneering work in free software, today's speaker has many awards, including the ACM Grace Hopper Award, the McCarthy Foundation Fellowship, the Electronic Frontier Foundation Pioneer Award, as well as several honorary doctorates. The title of today's lecture will be Copyright versus Community in the Age of Computer Networks. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Dr. Richard Stallman.
This isn't a talk about free software, but it responds to a question that comes out of the ideas of free software. So I'd better start by saying a little basic stuff about free software to provide background. Free software is software that respects your freedom and your community. So it's free as in freedom, not as in price. It's not about price particularly at all. So think to understand free software, think of free speech, not free beer. Now, if a program is not free, we call it non-free software, proprietary software, user-subjugating software, because a non-free program is a system of digital colonization. It's a kind of evil empire. It, like other colonial systems, it practices divide and rule. A non-free program keeps its users divided and helpless. They're divided because they're forbidden to redistribute it, and they're helpless because they don't have the source code, so they can't change the program. They can't even check independently what it really does. And often these programs have malicious features. However, just saying it respects your freedom is too general. There are four essential freedoms that define free software. A program is free software if you, the user, have these four freedoms. Freedom zero is the freedom to run the program as you wish. Freedom one is the freedom to study the source code and change it so the program does your computing as you wish. Freedom two is the freedom to help others. That's the freedom to redistribute exact copies when you wish. And freedom three, you've got to keep it further away so that I'm not going to bang into it. Freedom three is the freedom to contribute to your community, which is the freedom to distribute copies of your modified versions when you wish. So each of these freedoms is literally the freedom to do something if you wish. It's not required. So if you have a free program, you're not required to run it as you wish. You're free to do so, but not required. If you're a masochist, you could run it as you don't wish. Or you could not run it at all. You must have the freedom to study and change the source code, which includes having a copy of this or being able to get a copy of the source code, but you're not required to ever look at it. You can run the program without ever looking at the source code, if that's what you wish. Freedom two is the freedom to redistribute exact copies, but you're never required to do so. The point is, you shouldn't be forbidden to help other people. You shouldn't be kept divided from others. And freedom three is the freedom to distribute copies of your modified versions. Once again, if you've made a modified version, you're not required to distribute copies of that. But the point is, you shouldn't be forbidden to.
This would be better.
Maybe, will this be any better? No. Oh, now, that's funny. Something changed when it went into my pocket. I know I can. That's sort of obvious. So, this is no good at all. So, if the program gives you those four freedoms, then it's free software because the social system of its distribution and use is an ethical one. But if one of these freedoms is missing, then the owner of the program has unjust power over the users, and the program imposes an unjust system of use and distribution, and that's what makes that program unethical. So with software, there are just two possibilities. Either the users control the program or the program controls the users. If the users have sufficient freedom in their use of the program, and those four freedoms are my idea of what the freedom needs to be, then the users control the program and they control their own computing. But if they don't have enough freedom, and the program, in other words, if it isn't free software, then the owner controls the program and the program controls the users, which means the owner has power over the users, and that's what makes it unjust. So proprietary software should not exist. It's wrong, and the use of proprietary software is a social problem we hope to get rid of. All programs should be free so that their users can be free. And thus, the ultimate goal of the free software movement is the liberation of cyberspace and all of its inhabitants. We invite and encourage you, just, not in the middle, please. I'd like to take questions at the end. I'm saying things that are very controversial, I know. And in any case, so I'd like to have a chance to make my points before I'm invited to defend them. In any case, this is actually not the main topic. This is an introduction. And besides, it's such a pain to be, when I'm saying something that's rhetorically beautiful, to have it interrupted in the middle. I mean, please. So we invite you to escape from proprietary software and come live with us in the free world that we have built. And I should explain that free software is a totally different idea from open source. Open source is the right-wing reaction against free software, trying to co-opt our work and bury our ethical ideals. If you look at what is said in the name of open source, typically they say that they recommend letting people change and redistribute the programs you write, because then they will improve the quality of those programs. So they don't say that users have a right to anything. They don't say that users deserve any particular freedoms. In fact, they usually won't use the term freedom. They only try to argue in terms of the selfish interests of the developer. So, in fact, they end up recommending more or less the same practice, but without the ethical foundation of the idea of free software. So a lot of people who support open source participate in software development with us. There's no reason, after all, why people have to agree on these ethical issues to work together on a program, as long as they agree how they're going to release it. But at the deepest level, the level of values, our views and theirs are totally different. And that's why I am not a supporter of open source, because I want people to think about the ethical issues. What I discovered many years ago, after focusing my effort on writing free programs and releasing them, I then saw that we had given freedom to a lot of people, but they hadn't learned to value that freedom, and they were ready to let go of it for some kind of convenience because they hadn't learned to appreciate it as such. Yes, we need to write the free programs and make them available so people can have freedom, but we also need to teach them to demand freedom, or they will lose it again. Because sometimes you have things like the Digital Economy Act, and you need to have a lot of people fight in order to defeat them. So if you give everybody freedom and you don't teach them what freedom is, then someone will come along and sell them a scheme to take away their freedom, and they won't fight back because they don't realize what they're going to lose. In any case, the last thing I want to say about free software is that all educational activities morally must teach exclusively free software. And there are several reasons for this. The most superficial is they can save money this way sometimes, but free software is a matter of freedom, not price, and there are more important things at stake here. Schools have a social mission to educate good citizens of a strong and capable, independent, cooperating, and free society. And in software, you do that by teaching free software. Teaching proprietary software is implanting dependence. And the proof is in the way many proprietary software developers donate gratis copies of their non-free proprietary programs to schools. They want the schools to implant dependence on their product so that when the students graduate, they carry that dependence into the rest of society. This developer is not going to offer them gratis copies after they graduate, and if they go to work for a company, the developer is not going to offer that company a gratis copy. So they hope the schools will act as their agents, implanting dependence. It's like giving the school needles full of addictive drugs, saying, inject these into your students to make them dependent. The first dose is gratis. Once you're dependent, then you have to pay. So the school should refuse to teach proprietary software. And those of you who have a connection with the school should campaign to end the use of proprietary software in that school If you have children who are going to school, you should say, don't teach my children to use proprietary software. And if they offer your child a computer with proprietary software, you should say, proprietary software is not permitted in my home. I want my child to learn to be free. And don't you dare teach my child that sharing is wrong, because sharing is good. Now, there are two more reasons. One is so that people who have talents in programming can perfect their skills, because the way you do that is by writing changes in large programs. The way you learn to work on large programs is you read the code and you write a change. Well, free software lets you do that. Proprietary software forbids that. It's impossible. So only free software gives natural-born programmers the chance to learn to be good programmers. To write good code, you have to read lots of code and write lots of code. It's the same as learning to write good English. Now, there's a deeper reason for the sake of moral education. Schools need to teach not just facts and skills, they have to teach the spirit of goodwill and the habit of helping others. So, every class must have this rule. Students, if you bring a program to class, you may not keep it for yourself. You must share copies with the rest of the class, including the source code, in case someone here wants to learn. Because this class is a place where we share our knowledge. The school must set a good example by following its own rule. It must bring only free software to class. If you have a connection with a school, it's your duty to campaign for that school to move to free software. Do it personally in your own dealings with the school, but also bring it up publicly as an issue and look for allies whenever you can. You'll have to keep pushing, but it can succeed. So, at the end of my talks about free software and the GNU plus Linux operating system, which most people don't give us credit for because they call it Linux, which isn't fair, people sometimes ask, do these ideas apply to anything other than software? And that's the question this speech is mainly to address. Usually when they ask that question, they say, what about hardware? Should hardware be free too? Well, let's consider that. Remember, we're talking about a particular definition of free, a particular set of four freedoms. So let's see if they apply to physical objects like this one, say. Well, there's freedom zero, the freedom to run the program as you wish. If we adapt that to a physical object, it would be the freedom to use the object as you wish. Well, in general, physical objects do not come with a set of license restrictions saying what you're allowed to do with them. Once you buy the object, you can do whatever you like. So you've got freedom zero. What about freedom one? That is the freedom to study the source code and change it to make the program do your computing as you wish. To try to adapt this to a physical object encounters a problem that there's no source code for physical objects. We have to adapt, we have to change it a bit. It could be the freedom to study and change the object itself. Well, you have that freedom, generally, but the ability to exercise it is usually rather limited. If you have a piece of wooden furniture like this, you could change it in a lot of ways. But something like this that's made up of, say, metal and plastic, and those are hard to change, and there are probably some chips in it which are impossible to change. So the answer is you've got freedom one, but physical constraints usually make it very limited in the possibility of exercising it. What about freedom two, the freedom to redistribute exact copies? Well, there are no copiers for most physical objects, so this is a completely irrelevant question with today's technology. And likewise, freedom three, If you modify a piece of wooden furniture, you still don't have copiers for it. So you have no way to exercise freedom two or three. Whether you have it or not is not an important question if you can't do it anyway. So that's why their question is sort of silly, because it's a question that, practically speaking, most of the question doesn't have any effect on us. But there are some things for which that question is real and important, things that we can copy and change, and therefore whether we are permitted to do so is an important question. And those are published works that you might have a copy of. You might have a copy in your computer, and then you could use your computer to copy and change them. And this has become a major political issue, a battle between mega corporations and the public. For most works that are published, the main thing that might limit your freedoms is copyright law. Software is an exception, but we're talking about things other than software. So you could ask the same question from the other side by saying, what should copyright say about your copies of these published works? To look at this question, it's useful to look at the history of copyright law, which is closely connected with the history of copying technology. Now, changes in technology cannot touch basic moral principles, which are too deep for them to reach. But when we apply our principles to a specific question, we do it by looking at the consequences of the various actions one might take. Changes in the context can alter the consequences of a given action. They can make it more good or more bad, and as a result, they can change the conclusion. For instance, if we could reliably resurrect the dead, murder wouldn't be such a serious thing. The judge would say, you killed him, you have to pay for his new body. In the U.S., we would all need uninsured murderer insurance. But in civilized countries, the National Health Service would take care of it.
Just a second.
So, let me talk about the history of copying technology and copyright. Copying began when published works began in the ancient world. At that time, it was done by reading one copy and writing another copy. Now, this technology was very inefficient. But aside from that, it had certain other interesting characteristics. It had no economy of scale. It would take you 10 times as long to make 10 copies as to make one copy, roughly. There might be a bit of a learning curve, I suppose. Aside from that, it required no special equipment other than the equipment for reading and writing, and no special skill other than the skill of reading and writing. Because of this, copies were made in a decentralized way. Anywhere where there was one copy and someone wanted to make another, he would do so. Now, there was nothing like copyright in the ancient world. If you had a copy and you wanted to copy it, you could, and no one would try to stop you, except if the local potentate didn't like what the book said, in which case he might do horrible things to you. But that was not exactly copyright. It was something closely related, namely censorship. That went on for thousands of years, but then there was a big advance in copying technology, the printing press, which made copying a lot more efficient, but not uniformly so. In the ancient world, mass production copying and one-off copying were equally inefficient. With the printing press, mass production copying became a lot more efficient, but one-off copying did not benefit at all because it was faster to write a copy than to copy it with a printing press. With the printing press, it took a lot of time to set the type, but then you could make many identical copies much faster than you could write them. So there was a big economy of scale. In addition, the printing press and the type were expensive equipment that most literate people didn't have. And they also didn't know how to use them. I suppose it wasn't rocket science, but it was a skill. And most literate people had no occasion to learn that skill. The result was a centralized system of making copies. Copies were made in quantity at a few places, and then they were carried to where someone might want to buy them. During the first few centuries of printing, a large fraction of copies of books were still made by hand, either for very rich people to show how rich they were, or by poor people, because as the song goes, time ain't money if all you got is time. So, there were poor people who couldn't afford a printed copy, but had time on their hands and used it to write a copy. Now, copyright began in the age of the printing press. Copyright in England began in the 1550s as a system of censorship. I believe it was censorship of Protestantism under Queen Mary. And the law said that before you could publish a book, you had to apply for permission, and the permission was granted as a perpetual monopoly to one publisher. In the 1680s, this censorship system became obsolete, and it lapsed. The publishers clamored for their monopoly back. But what was adopted in the Statute of Anne was something different. Namely, copyright as a temporary monopoly for the author. And the idea developed that copyright would be a way to encourage writing. In other words, aiming at a social benefit. So it was not a natural right. It wasn't given to these authors because they deserved privilege, but rather in the hope of benefiting society. This idea was later explicitly stated in the Constitution of the United States. It was proposed that authors be entitled to a copyright, but that was rejected. Instead, the U.S. Constitution makes copyright optional. That is, whether to have a copyright law was optional. It was not required. But if there is to be copyright, it's explicitly supposed to promote progress, and it has to last for a limited time. Ever since then, publishing companies have been trying to get us to forget about that. Now, in the age of the printing press, copyright functioned as an industrial regulation, regulating publishers under the control of authors, but the system was designed to provide benefits to the public. As a result, it was mostly uncontroversial, easy to enforce, and arguably beneficial. It was mostly uncontroversial because it didn't restrict anything ordinary readers could do, so they had no occasion to complain. It was easy to enforce because it only had to be enforced against publishers, and it's easy to see who's publishing a book. You go to the store and you say, where do these copies come from? It doesn't require invading everybody's home, everybody's computer, or everybody's network connection. And it was arguably beneficial for the public because the public, according to the way copyright was conceived, traded away its natural right to copy everything, a right which it was not in a position to exercise, and therefore it lost nothing in practice, and in exchange got a benefit, namely the benefit of more works being written. So if you have something that you can't use, it's of no direct value to you, and you trade it for something that is of value, at least it's a positive deal, whether or not it's the best deal you might have got. And because copyright was uncontroversial, if we were still in the age of the printing press, I doubt I would be complaining about it. Now, it was so clearly understood that copyright was an industrial regulation that no one ever tried to attack the people who made copies by hand using copyright law. That's not what it was supposed to be for. Now, that practice mostly ceased when printing presses were mechanized, which happened in the 1800s, and printed copies became much cheaper, so cheap that even poor people could probably afford them. So the practice of hand copying mostly ceased, and the fact that this could be an issue was forgotten. But copyright continued to act as an industrial regulation. But now we are seeing another advance in copying technology, which again makes copying more efficient, namely digital information technology. It makes copying more efficient again, and again in a non-uniform way. Here's the situation in the age of the printing press. Of course, with mechanized printing presses, that becomes mass production becomes even more efficient. But with digital technology, we get this. Yes, both mass production and one-off copying benefit, but it's one-off copying that benefits the most, and it brings the efficiency of these two cases closer together, which means that we're in a situation more like the ancient world, where one-off copying, it's not exactly as efficient as mass production copying, but it's almost so. For instance, mass-produced CDs are somewhat cheaper and more robust than one-off CDs. But one-off CDs are cheap enough that hundreds of millions of people make them. So the result is to completely transform the effect of copyright law. Even if the words of the law were unchanged, the result would now be disastrous because it now has to be enforced against everybody. It's now a restriction on everybody. As a result, it's no longer an industrial regulation. Now it's a restriction on the general public, controlled effectively by the publishers in most cases in the name of the authors, and usually paying the authors a pittance to excuse the power that the publisher gets. And this is simply unjust, because the freedom that we didn't object to trading away because we couldn't exercise it, we now can exercise it, and we want to exercise it. And as a result, the deal that was made on our behalf is now intolerable. So what would a democratic government that aims to serve the people do? It would say, the people now need the freedom that we traded away on their behalf. We have to take it back. We have to reduce this deal because it's unjust for the people not to have that freedom. So they would reduce copyright power. We can measure the lack of real democracy around the world by the tendency of governments to do the exact opposite. They are extending copyright power as never before. For instance, there's the dimension of time. There is a big push to extend copyright law. You see this around the world. The U.S. has extended copyright law several times in recent decades. The last time was in 1998. I can't understand you. Sorry, you have to speak loud for me.
Would you like a drink? Sorry to interrupt.
Oh, well, I made some tea, and then I let it cool off so I could drink it, and now I can see if it tastes like coffee. Yeah, it sort of tastes like coffee. I guess this water is just not... They shouldn't ever use this for plain water. They should only use it for coffee. Oh, well. I'll drink water.
It's fine.
Does this have gas in it? No, it's, yes, this does have gas in it. Good thing I haven't finished opening it. I guess, are these different? Yes, this is this. Okay, this is good too. If someone could inform them that they must never use this for plain water, it will avoid having a repeat problem on another occasion. It's my experience that very often when something has had coffee in it several times, it has an ineradicable coffee flavor. So, in 1998, the U.S. extended copyright by 20 years for everything, past works and future works. How they could encourage the writing of more works back in the past by extending the copyright on past works escapes me. If they have a time machine, they apparently have not used it, because our history books do not record that authors and artists set to work with renewed vigor when they learned that their copyrights would be extended. Why don't they use their time machine and get us more great old classics? It's theoretically conceivable that extending copyright on future works would increase the motivation to make them, but not for anybody rational. Because in economic terms, the discounted future value, discounted present value of 20 more years of copyright, starting, for instance, 50 years after you're dead, is too small to affect a rational decision about what to make. And in the case of the businesses that wanted 95 years of copyright instead of 75, to justify their claim that this was necessary, they should have been challenged to produce projected balance sheets for 75 years in the future, which, of course, none of them have, because they don't really try to estimate anything that far. They couldn't. So the arguments that were made for this law were all bogus. The supposed justification that this law would promote progress was lip service. The real reason this law was passed is that companies paid for it. Laws are for sale in the U.S. Congress. Companies like Disney, for instance, which knew that the copyright on the first film in which Mickey Mouse had appeared was going to expire, and then everybody would be free to make artistic works with drawings of Mickey Mouse in them. Disney has obtained so much from the public domain that it's fully aware of what that implies and is determined never to contribute anything to it. So Disney paid for this law, and we call it the Mickey Mouse Copyright Act. And another reason they gave was harmonization with Europe. But it's a weird kind of harmonization. You see, Europe had 70 years after the author's death, if I'm right, for copyright on an individual work, and 75 years for an employee's work. And the U.S. had 50 and 75. So this harmonization moved the U.S. up like this. Now the U.S. has 70 years after death for the individual work and 95 for the employee's work. And that's, I suppose, going to be an excuse for Europe to harmonize its copyright law with the U.S. by adding 20 more years and doing this, and they'll be able to keep making that same moronic argument and ratcheting up copyright as long as people were, as long as basically the media are sufficiently controlled to only show their side of the story. And I suppose if Murdoch gets control of all the UK media, then he'll probably make sure of that, right? So, this, of course, is only a temporary expedient. It only gave him 20 more years. So, probably in 2018, they'll try to do it again. This is known as perpetual copyright on the installment plan. The movie companies want perpetual copyright, but even they can't change the U.S. Constitution yet. So, they have this scheme where every 20 years they extend copyright by 20 more years, and the effect is perpetual copyright, but it's never acknowledged at any moment. At any given time, for any given work, there's some date when its copyright is supposed to expire, but that's like tomorrow, it never comes. By the time you reach that date, they will have postponed it, and thus their aim is that nothing should ever go into the public domain again. But the U.S. isn't the worst. In Mexico, copyright now lasts for 100 years after the author's death. Apparently, they think that the author's great-great-grandchildren or something must be supported when we use the work. Well, time is one dimension. But even more important is the dimension of breadth. Which uses of the work are covered by copyright? In the age of the printing press, copyright was not conceived as covering all uses of a copyrighted work. There were certain uses that were regulated by copyright, and everything else people were simply free to do. So, the publishers have recognized that digital technology gives them the chance to seize total control, to impose a pay-per-view universe. And the way they do it is with malicious features in proprietary software. These features are known as digital restrictions management, or DRM. Also, they're called digital handcuffs. And they are features designed to restrict what the user does with the data in her own computer, which she ought to have control over, but not with these programs. And that way they can impose their pay-per-view universe. They can impose whatever conditions they want and make them impossible to escape from unless their software has a bug. Now, they need proprietary software to do this, because with free software, the users control the program. And so, if it happens to have a malicious feature, the users can remove it. They can fix it by making it do what they want it to do. The users control their computing. As a result, the companies that seek to turn our computers against us always do it with proprietary software. And that means they're attacking our freedom at two levels at once. Proprietary software is an attack on the user's freedom because it means that the program controls the user and the user doesn't control the program. And it's being used to implement another level of control, control over the use of particular published works. These and other kinds of malicious features are rife in proprietary software. Digital handcuffs can be found in Microsoft Windows, in the Macintosh operating system, in Adobe Flash Player, in the newer Apple products, the iMoan and the iBad, and in the Amazon swindle. So what you can see is being the victim of digital handcuffs is the usual case for users of proprietary software. There are maybe proprietary programs that don't have malicious features, but that's an exception. And the rule is, if you're using proprietary software, you're being victimized and you're being abused. Other malicious features are known as well. For instance, there are backdoors known in Windows, in the iMoan and the iBad, and in the Amazon swindle. So, the first place that the public encountered digital handcuffs was in DVDs. Because DVDs are designed to restrict the user. The movie is typically recorded in encrypted form, and the purpose of that encryption, which was kept secret, was specifically to restrict the users and to make it hard for them to escape from the restrictions. And all DVD players restricted the public the same way, because the companies that made them had to join the DVD conspiracy. The DVD conspiracy's rules said, if you want to make DVD players, you have to join the conspiracy and you have to promise to restrict the users according to in precisely these ways. So they all restrict the users the same. And for a while that worked, but then some people in Europe figured out the format of the encryption, and they released a free program that could decode these encrypted files and make it possible to actually watch a DVD without proprietary software. Well, that was a good thing, but the movie companies, which had organized this conspiracy, didn't like it. So they started demanding laws to forbid such free software. And they got it first in the US in 1998 with the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which imposes censorship on software, specifically, and not just on software, by the way, but in software it has the form of censorship. It censors any software that can break digital handcuffs with a limited, useless exception. So, in effect, our government took the side of the megacorporations against us. The European Union adopted a directive along the same lines around 2001, I believe. And then most of the countries in Europe implemented it in a nastier form than was actually required. For instance, in France, even possession of a copy of that program is a crime punished by imprisonment. Just think of that. People can be imprisoned in France for having defended themselves from malicious software features. Now, I often go to France, so I don't have a copy of this program. I have nothing that can play an encrypted DVD, and I have no encrypted DVDs. I'm content with that. But I think it's okay to have and play an encrypted DVD as long as you have the means to break the handcuffs. In general, you must never accept any product designed to restrict you, designed to attack your freedom, unless you personally have the means to thwart the attack, to neutralize it. In the case of DVDs, if you have that free software, then you can neutralize the attack, and then I suppose there's no reason you shouldn't get a DVD. But I only get DVDs that are unencrypted. The movie companies got the desired support from governments against us, but that didn't solve the problem. The fact is, this software is easy to find. So they designed another system of digital handcuffs called AACS. And they figured that would never be broken. That's used in Blu-ray discs. But then a free program was released to reverse the encryption of Blu-ray discs. However, it wasn't censored because it was useless. In order to actually run it, you would need to know the key, and no one knew the key. And then I saw a photo of two adorable puppies, and above them, 32 hex digits. And I wondered, why put those hex digits together with the puppies? I wonder if those numbers are actually a key, and they are trying to prevent the key from being erased from everywhere by hoping that people will save this picture because the puppies are so cute. And that was indeed the key to break the axe. After a few weeks, that key could be found on 700,000 web pages, which indicates an outpouring of anger against digital restrictions management. But that didn't win the battle in any lasting way, because they changed the key. They already had a provision for that. So it was not a lasting victory. And Blu-ray discs have another level of digital restrictions management where they change it every few months, and I don't know if we'll ever be able to keep up with them. So we don't always win. We can't assume but they will always make technical mistakes, and that will always defeat them technically. We have to fight for our freedom as freedom. So that's where things stand in video. But we've also seen DRM applied to music. That started around 10 years ago. You saw things on being sold which looked like compact discs, but they were not properly written according to the standard for compact discs. So we call them corrupt discs. And the purpose of them was to be playable in an audio player but not work in a computer. In some countries in Europe, you can tell which ones they are because they don't have the compact disc logo. They're not allowed to because they weren't written as specified by the compact disc standard. So they have a different symbol that says copy control. I once gave a speech on this topic in Spain where I had been invited by part of the regional government, and the next day I was given, as regional governments tend to do, some books with photos of their region and some records of music from their region. And one of them was by a musician I'd heard of, so I wanted to listen to it. But fortunately, before I opened the package, I saw the symbol copy control. This disc can be played on Windows and Macintosh systems. In other words, only with proprietary software, it seems. And thus, not by me. So I gave it back and I said, "Here you see the face of the enemy. Please give this back to the store because they don't deserve to keep your money." And I've never heard that music Maybe I never will, but all right. That's a pretty small sacrifice to make for one's freedom. Then things got worse when Apple started selling music downloads with DRM through iTunes. iTunes is a pretty nasty thing. Then the record companies started allowing sales of downloads without DRM. I'm told that what happened was their business deal with Apple turned out to put Apple in the driver's seat and was bad for the record companies, and the only way they were allowed to sell it without going through Apple was to do it without DRM. So they tried that, and lo and behold, they discovered they were selling, so they started doing it more, and then Apple basically had to drop the DRM because it had been outflanked. This other places were better. But iTunes still uses DRM on anything other than music, I believe. So that doesn't mean iTunes has now become a good thing. People should not associate with iTunes. And especially schools should not deal with iTunes. So Sony came up with a very clever way of making corrupt discs. They put a program on the disc such that if you put the disc into a computer, the program would run automatically. And that program was like a virus. It's referred to as a rootkit, which means it's like the part of a virus that takes control of the computer. That program inserts itself into the operating system and modifies it, and it makes several changes. First of all, it restricts the use of the music on those discs. But second, it alters the program you would use to look for the presence of that software so that it doesn't show up. And it also alters the program you would use to delete that software so it doesn't really delete. Now, this is a felony in the U.S. and maybe here too. But Sony was not prosecuted for this. But it's not the only felony, because some of this code had been released under the GNU GPL. They use GPL-covered free software in there. And the GNU GPL's conditions say when you include some of this code in a larger program, you have to release the source code. And you have to give people a copy of the license so they know their rights. Well, Sony didn't do that. That was commercial copyright infringement, which is also a felony. But Sony wasn't prosecuted because the state understands that the laws are there to give companies like Sony power over us. They're not meant to defend our rights. However, people did sue Sony. Alas, they focused their criticism not on the malicious purpose of this software, but rather on the secondary malicious things that were part of the means used. Thus, Sony was able to settle the lawsuit by promising that in the future, when it attacked our freedom, it would not do so using these particular methods. And Sony learned its lesson, because in the future, the rootkit will be built into the computer before you get it, and it will be impossible to remove, and it will be called AACS. And that's the way things are in the PlayStation 3, which is an extremely nasty product. In any case, DRM on music mostly disappeared once the record companies began selling downloads that didn't have DRM. But it's starting to come back with the so-called streaming services, these music streaming services such as Spotify, that are set up to require you to use a proprietary program to listen. And the reason is it's designed to restrict the user. They say to you, this is streaming, so of course you can't save a copy. They want people to get the idea that that's somehow natural, but it's just an artificial restriction. Saving a copy of the data received would be the most natural thing in the world, except that that program is written so it won't do that. And you can't use the service except by doing that. So people shouldn't use that. Out, damn Spotify. And now we see digital restrictions management on books. The first attempt was made around a decade ago. There was a massive organized PR effort to convince people that they would all use ebooks. And then the publishers came out with their ebooks and ebook readers. One publisher had the idea that it could start its line of ebooks with a bang among the technology fans by starting with a biography of me. So they sent an author to me asking for my cooperation, and I said, only if this book is published without encryption. The publisher would not accept that, and I said no. So then we found another publisher who accepted that, in fact, wanted to publish it on paper, and they decided to release the text of the book under a free license. So in fact, you could print your own copies after changing the text. And they sold lots of copies and over several years and then stopped. The Free Software Foundation has recently published a revised edition, which is a semi-autobiography, because it has the Sam Williams's point of view and my point of view, and they are usually labeled, and you can compare them. And that's under the same free license. In any case, ebooks were a failure 10 years ago. People just didn't want them. And other people said, what a relief. And I said, they will be back. All we did was drive them off. And yes, they've come back. Because you see, they have people who are paid to try again and again and again. They won't give up just because we defeat their first attack. These devices are designed to take away the traditional freedoms of readers. There's the freedom, for instance, to acquire a book anonymously by paying cash. That doesn't exist for the Amazon swindle. Most books that are available, modern books that are copyrighted still, they are only available from Amazon, and Amazon requires customers to identify themselves. So Amazon maintains a list of all the books that each customer has obtained. And this list is a threat to human rights. Its existence must not be tolerated, no matter where it might be, especially not in a country which imprisons people for the books they have, like this one. So That's one freedom. But then there's the freedom to give, lend, or sell a book to someone else, which Amazon denies through digital handcuffs, and also by contempt for private property. Because Amazon says that people can't own these books in the usual way. It's Amazon says it's not really your book. All you have is a license to read it under our conditions. And then there is the freedom to keep the book as long as you wish. Amazon takes that away with a back door. We know about this back door through observation. People saw that Amazon deleted thousands of copies of a particular book. These were copies that people had obtained directly from Amazon. They had previously been authorized copies, and thus Amazon knew exactly where they were. And Amazon sent a remote command, delete this book, and it disappeared. Some people saw it disappear as they were reading it. And the book with which Amazon demonstrated the Orwellian nature of this product was 1984 by George Orwell, a book about a totalitarian future in which they do things like destroy books that they don't like. There was a lot of bad publicity, and Amazon said, we'll never do this again unless the state orders us to. Very comforting, right? The official name of that product is the Kindle. Kindle means to start a fire. Evidently, it's a product that aims at burning our books. It's an attack on society for people who read. Imagine that you visit your friend's home and there are no books. And it's not that your friend is a non-reader, but rather your friend's library is in a device, and the only way to lend you those books is to lend you the device, which would be an unreasonable thing to ask. And besides, you can't even see what the books are. You can't browse through them. You can't notice the things that might be interesting to read. This is basically ending friendship between people who read. So make sure that your friends are warned before they might consider using that malicious product, that it would mean cutting off their friendships. Warn them so that they don't buy it and fall into the trap without thinking. So, digital restrictions management is a big threat to our freedom. Of course, you should never accept any product with DRM unless you are ready to break that DRM and you're going to break it. But that's not enough. Because DRM is normally set up by a conspiracy of companies, we need to react in an organized fashion too. It's normally set up by a conspiracy because it takes a publisher and a technology company. It's rare that one company is in a position to do this by itself. Thus, Amazon is working with publishers. That's a conspiracy. The DVD manufacturers work with the movie companies. It's a conspiracy. And how do I know about this? Well, I am not an investigator, and if these conspiracies were secret, I wouldn't know how to drag them out in the open. But in fact, these conspiracies are not secret. They have websites. For instance, I visited the AACS website to look at the gigantic file that describes the rules that they impose on everybody in the conspiracy. And I saw that as of a certain year, it was either 2011 or 2013, they were going to forbid analog video outputs. They are quite arrogant, and they believe they're entitled to and can get away with dictating every aspect of the technology to be made available to us. I believe that a conspiracy of companies to restrict the technology available to the public should be punished like a conspiracy to fix prices. The executives of those companies should go to jail for that kind of thing. But they are fully aware that our governments are on their side against us. They don't even need to hide. They establish these websites describing their conspiracies to attack our use of technology. And if you look at the AACS website, you can even find which companies launched the conspiracy. They included Intel and AMD and Microsoft and Apple and IBM and Sony and Philips and Disney. A lot of malicious companies. So, the Free Software Foundation has established a campaign of protests against DRM. It's called defectivebydesign.org. Go to that site and you can sign up to participate in our protests. Right now we're having a protest of sending email to Sony to condemn its sending the police against the people who figured out how to run their own programs in the PlayStation 3. The product was originally sold with that feature, and then Sony gave people an upgrade saying certain features are going to break unless you install this upgrade which takes away that feature. Look at how arrogant that is. So people figured out how to break that how to break that upgrade so that they could go back to installing the GNU plus Linux system and whatever other software they want in these machines as they were supposed to be able to do. And for that, the police are persecuting them. Go to defectivebydesign.org and sign up. Help our protests. If there are enough of us, we can defeat those bastards. So the laws that support these vicious companies against our freedom are the sort of thing that governments have actually been doing. Governments which are subservient to the megacorporations. Governments which have in effect betrayed their countries. And of course, you can see that betrayal in lots of other areas as well. But what should they be doing? What would a democratic government that aims to defend the freedom and well-being of the citizens do in copyright in the age of the computer networks? It would reduce copyright power to something that we can live with. Here are my recommendations. First of all, there's the dimension of time. I recommend the copyright last for 10 years, starting from the date of publication of the work. Why from the date of publication? Because before publication, we don't have copies. So it doesn't matter whether we would be allowed or not allowed to copy the copies we don't have. We might as well let the author have as long as it takes to arrange publication of the work and then start the clock. Why 10 years? Because the publication cycle nowadays is around 3 years. Most works are remaindered within 2 years and out of print within three. So, 10 years is more than three times that. It's comfortably long. So I think it will be plenty. But not everyone agrees. I once proposed these same recommendations in a panel discussion with fiction writers, and an award-winning fantasy writer responded, 10 years, that's ridiculous. Anything more than 5 years is intolerable. Yeah, I was surprised too, because until that moment, I had naively believed what the publishers said when they claimed that it was for the sake of the authors that they demanded more copyright power. I didn't realize that that was a typical 10% truth. You've heard that a half-truth is worse than a lie, but business tends to make 10% truths that are even worse than a half-truth. There's just barely enough truth in them that you can't call it an out-and-out lie. But mostly it's a lie. And one of these 10% truths is we want this power for the sake of the authors. And of course, there are a few superstar authors that they treat really nicely and that get a lot of money from this system. And they're a handful, and they're supposed to, they trot them out and present them as examples of how the system treats authors. And meanwhile, the rest of the authors are being ground into the dust with the heels of the publishers. Like this guy who, despite having won an award, his book was not a big hit, and it had gone out of print. Maybe it was multiple books, I don't know. One of them won an award. I'm not sure if he had others. In any case, they were out of print. His fans wanted to get copies and couldn't. His contract said that when the books went out of print, the rights would revert to him. But the publisher refused to acknowledge that they were out of print. It pretended they were not. And as a result, the publisher was using the copyright on his own book to stop him from distributing copies, which he wanted to do so people could read them. He wanted people to be able to read his work and appreciate it. That's what just about every artist starts out wanting. And a few of them get it a lot of money, like J.K. Rowling, and get corrupted by it. And they start wanting the money more than wanting people to appreciate their works. And they start begrudging anything that would lose them any money. And by the way, I still urge people not to buy Harry Potter books. I don't say don't read them, only don't buy them. The reason is that the author told people don't read them. The author and the publisher in Canada got an injunction against people who had been sold copies by mistake, ordering them not to read the books that they had been sold in the bookstore. Well, if she is going to tell people not to read those books, I'm just going to say don't buy those books. You can find a page about this on Stallman.org. Well, that shows how artists can get corrupted when they are one of those few that get a lot of money. But the author who was objecting on this panel hadn't been corrupted. He still wanted people to appreciate his work. And that's what most artists continue wanting. So only a few who get enough money that it could corrupt them. So he realized that more than 5 years of copyright was not likely to ever do him any good, but could do him harm. And he said, no more than 5 years. Well, I'm not necessarily against that. If everybody wants 5 years, I won't argue for 10 instead. I propose 10 as a rough idea of a first adjustment to make. I think it's in the right range. Let's try it. Partly it's just I'm being a little more conservative. There's no need to be more radical than is necessary in the situation. But then there's the other question, the dimension of breadth of copyright. Which uses of copyrighted works should copyright cover? Here I distinguish three categories of works based on what kind of contribution they make to society. There are the works that are used to do a practical job. There are the works that say what certain people thought. And then there are the works of art and entertainment whose contribution is in the impact of the work itself on the mind of the reader or listener or viewer. Three different kinds of contribution that lead me to different conclusions. First, let's look at the functional works, the works that whose contribution is they help you do a job. These include programs, recipes, educational works, reference works, text fonts, and various other things that you could identify. These works must be free. The same arguments that apply to software apply to the other works that you use to do a job. And they are, if you're doing the job, you deserve to control the job, and that means you need to have control over the work you're using to do it. So you've got to be free to change it. But once you've changed it, then you should be free to publish your version, because there may be other people who want to do the job the same way you want to do it. And your change would be useful for them. So you've got to be free to publish that. But it's absurd to allow publication of modified versions and not allow republication of without change, because that would just make people make some changes that don't really affect anything so they could be allowed to publish. So we end up with the same four freedoms. All these works should be free. And that's how far my ideas about software extend to other things. They extend to other works that are like software in that you use them to do jobs. Someone might respond, but we can't possibly insist on freedom. If we demand freedom, they'll never make the works and we'll have nothing. We've got to surrender. 20 years ago, I couldn't have proved they were wrong. I could only have said, what use are those works if they take away our freedom? I don't want them. But now, we have empirical evidence that he's simply wrong. If we look at the free software community and the tens of thousands of useful free programs, we see that, yes, people will make these works. And then look at all the recipes that people circulate, treating them effectively as free. And then look at Wikipedia. We see that great free reference works will be made. And even in education, we're starting to see free textbooks. All textbooks ought to be free. Free in the sense of freedom, of course. And since it is governments that ultimately pay a large fraction of the cost of writing these textbooks, they could just dictate that they will be free. They don't have to allow publishers to make them proprietary. They could say, we're not going to spend money that way. We're going to pay people to write free textbooks, and then the schools will redistribute them, and we won't have to worry about that. So we now see that when you insist on freedom, you don't have a disaster. What you do is you get works and you get freedom. So in this category, the works must be free. But what about the second category, works that say what certain people thought? For instance, memoirs, essays of opinion, offers to buy and sell, scientific papers. A scientific paper is actually a work of testimony. It says, we did this and we saw this. We are the ones who testify to this. It's very important to have the author's names on that paper, because those are the ones whose reputation is at stake if they lied or made a mistake and didn't see what they thought they saw. With these works, to publish a modified version would just misrepresent someone else. There's no social contribution in that, so I don't see any reason why it needs to be permitted. Therefore, I recommend a somewhat reduced copyright system, which would cover modified versions. And once you're going to say you can't publish a modified version, there's no particular reason to allow commercial publication at all. So copyright could cover all commercial use of the work. But there is something that everyone must be free to do, and that is to share, to non-commercially redistribute exact copies. So copyright can cover all commercial use, it can cover all modification, but the freedom to share must be respected. And that's the minimum freedom we must have for every published work. And the reason is, to take that freedom away from people is what makes copyright a cruel, draconian system. It's the war on sharing that leads to suing teenagers for hundreds of thousands of dollars. It leads to unjust laws that threaten to cut people off from the internet. And consider how absurd it is to talk about improving broadband coverage in the UK while attacking people for making use of broadband in the way it's mainly useful. Why even bother to have broadband if you're not going to let people share? But sharing is good, and sharing fits human nature. So any war on sharing has to be cruel and nasty. And a government that wouldn't enter on such a war is clearly a government of occupation, established by the empire of the megacorporations to exploit the citizens it rules. So we must end the war on sharing. We must legalize sharing. But we can still have copyright on commercial use of these works and on modification. And thus, this copyright system would continue to provide more or less the same meager income that artists mostly get from the present system. This system would function in about the same inadequate way as the present system, with a few rare exceptions that serve to misrepresent the usual reality of the present system. What about the artistic and entertainment works? For these, the issue of modification is difficult, because I see valid arguments on both sides. On the one hand, a work can have an artistic integrity, and modifying it can destroy that. And I think that is true, although the artists are much less concerned with artistic integrity than they lead us to think. Just see how most of them will gladly let Hollywood butcher those same works in exchange for enough money. Well, that's not artistic integrity. But there are some who won't let Hollywood change the work and do violence to it. So I guess those are the artists that have artistic integrity. But on the other hand, modifying artistic works can be a contribution to art. Consider the folk process, which people are basically not allowed to take up any further. But the folk process, where a series of artists transform a work, can produce something very rich. But if we want to consider only named authors, consider Shakespeare, some of whose plays copied stories from other works that were just decades old at the time. If today's copyright law had existed then, those works would have been considered infringing. He would not have been allowed to stage them or publish them, so they wouldn't have been written. And if he or Henry Neville or whoever it really was that wrote them had complained, then the copyright holders would have said, you just want to make a cheap ripoff of my work. Well, because those works were written, people can say they're important literature, not cheap ripoffs. But if they had never been written, it would be hard for people to think about the question, and there might be a tendency to unthinkingly believe what those copyright holders would say. So there are arguments on both sides, but what occurred to me is a modified version of an artistic work can contribute to art, but you don't have to be in a hurry. You could wait 10 years and then publish your modified version. If copyright lasts 10 years, you can afford to wait 10 years at most, because maybe the work was 5 years old when you saw it and you only have to wait 5 years. With today's copyright law, you may have to wait longer than a lifetime. But if copyright is short enough, then you can wait that long. So that's what I recommend for these works. For 10 years, the reduced copyright system that covers all commercial use and all modification. And then when the work goes into the public domain, you can publish your modified version of it, which might be another contribution to art. However, there's one other point we need to consider, and that is remix, which means taking snippets of various things and putting them together into a work that overall is basically different. And that just has to be legal, because the purpose of copyright law is to encourage making new works. If it impedes making new works, that means it has been distorted so much it goes exactly against its purpose. And that has in fact happened with the publishers being allowed to distort the system. But if we want to serve the stated purpose of promoting the arts, we mustn't allow it to be distorted so much. Ending the war on sharing means legalizing file sharing over the internet and ending all the various things that are being done to try to stop it and punish people who share. So you'd be free to share music on the internet, and you wouldn't even need the special peer-to-peer programs. You could just put it on your own website or whatever was convenient to do. The record companies would make all sorts of exaggerated claims that, like, this is stealing from the musicians. That's not true. You can't steal what somebody never had. And the record companies don't generally pay the musicians, so there is no way that you could take any of what they were going to pay to the musicians. There is, theoretically, when the record company sells music, theoretically a certain part of that price is for the musicians, but they never get it, because the production and publicity expenses are counted as an advance to the musicians according to the contract, and therefore that fraction goes to repay those expenses. And it is extremely rare that a record sells enough copies to finish repaying that so-called advance. So the musicians don't get any money if you buy their record. When I buy commercial CDs, which is the main way I get music, I am always a little ashamed of failing to support the musicians. But what can I do? Now, this is not to say musicians get no benefit from a record contract. What they get is the benefit of the publicity, which means more people will come to their concerts and they'll have more concerts. That's an opportunity to actually make some money. But they could just as well get their publicity in a different kind of system. It doesn't have to be a system like that of the record companies based on stopping people from sharing. We can give people, we can give musicians publicity by sharing their music. And that will give them the same benefit for their concerts. And you might wonder, would movies still be made? After all, you've probably heard gigantic figures for the cost of making a movie. But actually, more than half of that cost is publicity rather than actually making the movie, according to a producer I spoke with. And not only that, but even before that, the cost has been exaggerated using creative accounting measures, because the higher they can, the figure they can give for the cost, the less they have to pay in taxes and to investors. So the real cost of making the movie is much less. Now, put that together with the fact that a lot of use of movies is commercial use in theaters, broadcasting, in airplanes and buses. It's all commercial use. It would be covered by my proposed reduced copyright system. And I think that, yes, movies could still be made. They might not always be the same movies. They might be better. Hollywood systematically produces crap. I say systematically because it's not that they always try to make good movies, except it's so hard that they almost always fail. Rather, the system leads them to try to make movies that everyone knows are going to be lousy, but they might make money. I read a book called Save the Cat, which says its purpose is to teach how to write screenplays that will sell. I wasn't interested in that, but I read the book because the book explains also, it explains the system which, as it happens, ensures most movies are going to be crap. Now, that doesn't mean they shouldn't be allowed to do it. Censorship is the most disgusting thing you could find in the arts. And all censorship is intolerable. I mean, censorship on any grounds whatsoever is an attack on our freedom. The UK practices a lot of censorship. People face imprisonment because they uploaded a video showing that they had burned a Quran. Well, that's an expression of an opinion about religion. I don't know if I'd express it the same way, but I feel sort of the same way about all religions. But so what? The point is they have a right to express that opinion. They didn't hurt anybody. They weren't burning a person. And it was their publication of this that they are threatened with imprisonment for. And recently, in France, I've heard of people being sentenced and others threatened for verbally stating opinions. Now, I don't agree with those opinions, but censorship is a threat to everyone. And we have to defend the freedom to express opinions we disagree with. So I would certainly be against trying to censor movies because they're crap. But that's not the issue. The question is rather, should we give up our freedom to help them keep making more crap? And there I say no. They can make all the crap they want, but that's not an excuse to hurt us. However, supporting the arts is a good thing. And we might want to support the arts better than the current lousy system we've got, which supports a few superstars very well and supports most artists hardly at all. I have a couple of suggestions. One is to use taxes to support the arts. Now, you could have a special tax on internet connectivity, or you could get the money from the general budget. It doesn't really matter where the money comes from, because it won't be a lot of money. And what I suggest is to distribute this money directly to the creative people based on their popularity, meaning not based on bureaucrats' decisions, based on measurements that can be made through polling and sampling of those who are willing to participate, but not in linear proportion. Why not? Suppose superstar A is 1,000 times as popular as fairly successful artist B. If you give the money in linear proportion, that means you've got to give A 1,000 times as much money as B, which means in order to give B enough to live on, you've got to make A very, very rich, and that uses a lot of taxpayers' money. It's using the money inefficiently, because for our purpose, which is to support the arts, we don't need to make him rich. So I suggest applying a function like cube root. I'm not saying cube root's the perfect function for this. It's an example. It looks sort of like this. Well, the cube root of 1,000 is 10. If we use the cube root to adjust the raw popularity, then A having 1,000 times as much popularity would get 10 times as much money as B. Meaning that we could give B enough to live on if we adjust all the basic parameters such that people like B get enough to live on, then people like A, yes, they'll get more, but not so much more. And most of the money will be going to support a lot of artists in the middle range of popularity, meaning we'll be using the money overall in an efficient way. That's one method. The other method is voluntary payments. Suppose each player had a button you could push to make an anonymous voluntary payment of perhaps, say, 25 pence to the artist that made the last work you played or the one you're playing now. And you can do that if you want. But nothing tries to punish you if you don't. It's entirely voluntary. A lot of people will do it because it's not a lot of money. I think all of you could afford to push that button once a week, and maybe even once a day. Of course, there are some people who can't afford that, who are poor, and they will never push that button. And that's as it should be. We don't need to squeeze money out of poor people to support the arts. There are enough non-poor people who will be happy to do so. So we can leave it to them and let the poor people alone. Now, voluntary payments are already supporting artists. Many artists have set up ways that people can voluntarily give them various amounts of money. And they typically will provide some token gift in exchange. Like, for $200, I'll send you a CD in a very pretty case, which I've signed. But this is not a real purchase. The market value of the thing that's being given in exchange is much less. It's really mostly gift. And this works pretty well, but it's only feasible for much larger amounts of money. Because with today's payment systems, which, by the way, are not anonymous, they're not very efficient. For a small transaction, the artist will only get half the money anyway. So these larger amounts of money you might hesitate to give because they're enough money that they might make a difference to you. What I'm saying is, for the very small payments I'm talking about, the main reason anybody wouldn't pay is not because of the value of that money, but rather because of the effort it takes. So let's get rid of the effort, and people will start sending it. And if we would like people to donate more, we could have a publicity campaign. Instead of the cruel and nasty publicity campaign that says, sharing is theft, if you share, you're a pirate, we could have a friendly PR campaign. Have you sent 25 pence to some artist today? Why not? If you heard or saw something you really liked, wouldn't you love to give something back and help them do more? Push the button. And people would do this because they'll feel good, because this is bringing up the best side of human nature, and people who let that influence them will feel good afterwards. So they'll want to do it again. So that is my talk. For more information about free software, look at GNU.org. You can also look at the Free Software Foundation's website. That's at fsf.org. There is also the Free Software Foundation Europe at fsfe.org. And both of those organizations would appreciate if you join. You can join either of them through its website, which involves paying dues, because both have paid staff. Now, I'm not part of that. I'm a full-time volunteer for the FSF because, as president, I want to set an example of volunteering. But we have paid staff, and if you join, you help support them. There are also various campaigns of political pressure. For instance, there is defectivebydesign.org. Please join that. And at this point, I would like to auction this adorable GNU on behalf of the Free Software Foundation. Oh, one thing I left out. If you wish, you can join the FSF right here and now. You could pay cash, or you could put down your credit card details to join the FSF. Anyway, I'm going to auction this adorable GNU that needs a home. And if you are the purchaser of the GNU, I can sign it for you, either the card or the body, whichever you prefer. If you have a penguin, you must get a GNU for it. Because as everyone knows, a penguin can't hardly function without a GNU. All it could do is talk on the telephone. So you can pay either in cash or with a credit card, but it has to be a real credit card, something you could use to make a telephone order. If paying requires talking to a chip, we can't do it. We don't have that machine here. When you bid, please wave your arm and shout out the amount you are bidding. The point is, you want me to know that. You want me to notice you. So I'm going to stand here for this so that I can see all of you more easily.
20 pounds.
Oh, no, I'm starting with 15 pounds. Do I get 15 pounds?
15.
What? 15. I've got 15. Do I get 20? I've got 15. How much?
20.
I've got 20. Do I get 25? I've got 20 pounds. Do I get 25? How much?
25.
I've got 25. Do I get 30? I've got 25 pounds. Do I get 30?
30.
I've got 30. Do I get 35? I've got 30. Do I get 35? Do I get 35? I've got 35. Is that? I've got 35. Do I get 40? I've got 35. Do I get 40? 40 pounds for this adorable. I've got 35. Do I get 40? Do I get 40? 40 pounds to the Free Software Foundation to defend your freedom? I've got 40. Do I get 45? I've got 40. Do I get 45? Do I get 45? 45 pounds for this adorable canoe. I've got 40. Do I get 45? Do I get 45 pounds to the Free Software Foundation to defend your freedom? Do I get 45? Last chance to bid 45 or more. I've got 45. Do I get 50? I've got 45. Do I get 50? 50 pounds for this adorable canoe to the Free Software Foundation to defend your freedom. Do I get 50? I've got 45. Do I get 50? Last chance to bid 50 or more. Last chance. Do I get 50?
50, but you'll have to check that I've got the right credit card.
Well, can you make telephone orders with it?
I can do it over the internet and telephone.
No.
Yeah.
Okay, then it's good. Then it works.
Yeah,
okay, if I've got 50, do I get 55? I've got 50. Do I get 55? Do I get 55? Last chance to bid 55 or more. Do I get 55? I've got 55. Do I get 60? I've got 55. Do I get 60? Do I get 60? 60 pounds for this adorable. Do I get 60 to the Free Software Foundation to defend your freedom? Last chance to bid 60. I've got 55. Do I get 60? Do I?
60, be throwing a hook.
I've got 60. Do I get 60? I've got 60 minus a hug. Do I get 65? Do I get 65? Do I get 65 for this adorable canoe that comes home to the Free Software Foundation to defend your freedom? Do I get 65? Last, I've got 65. Ah, what a relief. I've got 65. Do I get 70? I've got 65. Do I get 70? Do I get 70 to the Free Software Foundation to defend your freedom? Last chance to bid 70 or more. Do I get 70? Going, gone for 65.